This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
Many years ago, this candle blessed our family with a miracle. Our house, our casita, came to life with magic.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematica Animalia, the podcast where we break down the science of movie monsters. This week, we'll be touching on the 2021's Encanto, the latest from Disney. Actually, Disney's 60th Woo. Animated feature. This week, we'll be breaking down biogenic habitats, talking a little bit about the symbiotic parasitic continuum, and segueing into stories without villains. I am Adam Hassick. I am a disease ecologist at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev here in southern Israel. Alongside me is the Baroness Libby Young, our story expert and writer at Short Story Soup. And as always, we have Dave. Dave, I think you had something about where Sam was this week.
So much like the organism that we'll be talking about this week in Encanto, there have been concerns raised from the Norwegian government that now that they've moved beyond trolls, they've moved outside of the stage of some sort of hunter parasite worm. They're now concerned that he might be some sort of large parasitic organism that has moved in to try and eat their citizens as he grows more powerful and stronger. He's been quarantined for a period of time until they can determine that he is not going to sporulate and spread to the surrounding landscape. This is a perfect time for them. Things are cold, and they're hoping that this will restrict his ability to spread, but they really haven't fully understood his biological mechanisms yet.
I mean, they'll get there. It just takes time to study such a mysterious and potentially dangerous organism. As far as news this week, I think Libby has some more for us on our favorite bear, Hank the Tank.
So for those who don't know, Hank the Tank is a bear in California that has purportedly been breaking into about over 150 homes. I believe there is a term for this. Adam, if you, or Dave, if you know this term, but basically there is a scientific term in which animals are no longer afraid of humans, and then they associate humans with food.
Habituated?
Maybe.
See, I was going to go with the bear version of burglary, which is simply burglary, so...
That is the scientific term, yes.
The truth is he's just looking for Goldilocks in a bout of retribution, but he hasn't been able to find her, so he just keeps going into homes. But the newest evidence on, or newest news on Hank the Tank is that DNA evidence has revealed that it is not just one bear, but several. So it says at least three black bears are behind the string of break-ins in the Lake Tahoe area. So he has been freed of accusation. So they originally were going to try to trap him and relocate him, but because they've identified that it is not just him, but several bears, they are no longer going to do that. And I guess they just said to all the residents of Lake Tahoe, good luck.
On the one hand, this is kind of nice in the sense that there isn't this super bear that has developed the ability to break into hundreds of homes in a very short amount of time. But on the other hand, it's worse because there's more of them. And if any of them is female, they're potentially teaching their cubs how to do the same thing. So this specific population of black bears could be a real problem in the future.
Yeah, from my understanding, they are trying to trap all of them and relocate them into more suitable habitats.
It's kind of the resident of Lake Tahoe's fault. I mean, it's probably just the way that they dressed their homes, right? Those honey pots outside, they were pretty much asking for it.
Basically, and Dave does jest, but this is actually a serious problem for a lot of different organisms around in any area, really. Here where we live in southern Israel, there are a ton of ibex. If you don't know what those look like, they're just goats with enormous horns that look really, really cool. Think like goat plus. And they are everywhere, especially in the villages, because they've learned that human habitats usually have gardens. Gardens are full of plants, and goats love to eat plants. So they are very well acclimated to people, and they look a lot fatter and bigger than the ibex that are living out in the desert naturally. But most areas around here have put up a number of signs and developed quite a a good public education system and program to really try to let residents know, like, hey, don't feed these animals. Like, you're hurting them. You're not helping them. Take pictures, enjoy them, but leave them alone. Let them be animals. We've already disturbed their ecology enough just by existing.
That supercilious scoundrel confiscated my bunny. Don't feed the bear.
This week we have decided to do the movie Encanto. So, through the trapped soul of a dead man, a house gains magical sentience and imprisons an entire community of people with an inescapable mountain wall. It then grants only members of one family in the entire town magic powers, causing them to become rulers and recipients of the town's wealth. Its classist deeds do not stop there, as it gives certain members of the family incredible powers, while others are either gifted a curse or objectively kind of worthless abilities. This leads to the inevitable jockeying for positions of prominence within the family, proving their worth to the Keeper of Magic itself and the house's main host body, Abuela Alma. Sensing that one of the members of the family, Mirabel, could disrupt this social feeding, the house rejects her and gives her no powers. But Mirabel's wits, determination, and drive to be included in this fucked up hierarchy overcome, and she ousts her own grandmother as supreme ruler, kicking her now powerless ass into the shadows, seizing the power of the house and magic itself, possibly retrapping her grandfather's soul, and recapturing the town once more.
Nice. I mean, she sticks her own name on the front door. Yeah.
Well, Antonio sticks it on there, to be fair.
Hey, but that's the way that you do it. You make people think that they did what you wanted.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, that's a true crime lord right there.
I mean, to be fair, she was a grown-ass woman being forced to sleep in and share a nursery with toddlers because of her lack of powers. So I would feel the need to kick out the leader that was doing that to me. Everyone gets these insanely incredible rooms, and she's stuck in a trundle with a 5-year-old.
Is she grown? Is she a teenager? Is she 40? What is going on?
She's 15.
Dave, what'd you like about this movie?
Oh, I love everything about this movie, but the soundtrack is amazing. Segueing to that, Louisa and her, I love everything about that character. I love Surface Pressure as a song. I think that it's so good. It's so well done. I absolutely adored this film. I was very happy to rewatch this.
So I feel like two things. Bruno's character, first of all, was incredible. Yeah. I always love John Leguizamo. He's great. But the character itself was just really well written because you have Bruno as a comic relief in the movie. Like, he's arguably the funniest, you know, with his little rat opera going on in the the crawl space of the walls. Yet he's also like the most tragic ridden character of the entire movie. So like the complexity of that is fantastic. I also say my favorite thing about this movie, I saw in theaters for the first time, was actually the animated short that came before it called Far From the Tree.
Oh.
Disclaimer, I'm a leaky garden hose. I cry at everything. You can ask Adam. But like, it made me tear up. It was just really well written. And it was, I'm a big fan of shorts, as you can't tell by my short stories that I write, but it was just a really cute animated short that I thought they did a really good job encapsulating a story into.
I think for me, I really enjoy the look of this movie. The aesthetic is, it's very different, I feel like, from what a lot of what has become before for Disney. And the inclusion of yet another culture and foundation for a story from Disney, from, you know, that's not white bread middle America, is really nice.
Well, and to add on to that, I feel like they did a really good job of not homogenizing Latin culture. You know, we have movies like Coco and Book of Life that have done a good job of showcasing Mexican culture. And I feel like this was a really good, well thought out dive into Colombian culture and making it its own thing, which it is and should be, and not just this like I said, homogenized Latin thing.
And to that point, it was really, I think, nice being inclusive even within that culture of showing that you have people that have very light skin, people that have very dark skin, people that are somewhere in the middle. And I think much like a lot of places in the world, that is the case. But media tends to portray groups as one type, like one face, for lack of a better term. And this, I thought, did a better job of showing actual inclusivity. Dave, anything you didn't like?
I mean, and I think this is realistic families. Some of the characters in this just have objectively dick moments. The family does completely like abandon Bruno and talk shit about Bruno while Bruno is living in the walls. And then when he shows back up again, they're like, oh, you're here. We love you. We're so glad you're back. And I'm like, you guys didn't search for him that hard. But I mean, again, that's families and the relationship between Isabel and Mirabel. Isabel's kind of a bitch for a big chunk of like her poor sister trying to do her best that has no powers. But at the same time, we do get
There's no kinda about it.
Right. But I mean, we get that great scene where we do get a better understanding of the pressures that she faces. I think that it was a realistic look, even if I have my moments where I'm just like, oh my God, Bruno got the worst life ever. He got a room filled with sand where he's itchy all the time. And then he finally leaves it to just live inside the walls.
I think for me, oddly enough, two things again. I didn't feel like there was enough comedy. And I say this with a caveat of it doesn't have to have comedy. That's not what I'm saying. But it calls itself a musical comedy. So like, if you're going to call yourself, if you're going to call yourself a musical comedy, then like you better deliver. So I just felt like it was very light on that, you know, topic. And it made the whole movie very, very heavy. To that point, I kind of hearkening back to the animated short that came before the movie, the theme, one of the big themes of Encanto is intergenerational or transgenerational trauma. And I felt like the animated short Far From the Tree represented that theme much better than the feature length film did. I think to show that too in succession, like having it come right before, like, oh, like, yeah, it was cool because it matched the theme, but it was like a very stark juxtaposition of like, oh, this tiny, short, little animated film that has no spoken words, by the way. It's about raccoons and they don't speak English or Spanish or any other language. And it did a much more concise, much more powerful job of delivering that theme than the entire movie of Encanto did.
Oh boy. I did really not like this movie. It might be because I have seen a lot of these Disney/Pixar animated features. It may just be because I've seen a lot of movies or absorbed a lot of media in general. But this was so bland and formulaic and nothing really stood out to me. None of the characters were particularly interesting, nor was I particularly rooting for any one of them. Even Mirabel, despite her getting kind of the shit end of the stick her entire life. The music was very strange and jarring and like trying to mix genres with every single song. Usually in these movies, the song and dance sequences are grounded within whatever reality the scene takes place in. And even though that involves a lot of fantastical elements like Pocahontas and The Color of the Wind, all these magical things are happening. It's happening in the scenes, like in the forest and in the waterfall and along the river. In this movie, everything is this weird dream hellscape with these weird big things happening and people flying through the air and random
things. They're on the Titanic and the donkeys are the musical trio.
Yeah. Kids don't know what the fucking Titanic is. Like, what is going on?
Adam, I think that's a product of Lin-Manuel Miranda writing these songs.
Yes.
He wrote them? That explains so fucking much. God damn.
Yeah. I think he just, he can't resist putting modern music into traditional folklore or fairy tale type settings.
Specifically hip hop.
I would argue that this movie still has a wide appeal to humans unlike Adam who still allow magic into their heart.
I love magic. I also like good and interesting stories, and this movie was neither one of those to me.
I give this movie a B. I really like it. I cried at the end both times I've seen it. I do feel like it's not as powerful as some Disney animated movies of the past.
Agreed. This is an A in my book. I love the soundtrack, and I always hate movie soundtracks, but like I played this at my clinic for weeks after I saw this movie, just to like the annoyance of some of my coworkers, one of which hates the song Surface Pressure. Rewatching this with my partner last night, she had two moments that she cried. Her moments were when Bruno saves the rats as the house is like falling apart, which great scene right before he throws the bucket onto his head and just buckets his way through the side of the wall. And yep. Two was when Bruno gets accepted back into the family. And I like turned and she was like, shut up, as we were watching this. Love this film.
Yeah. It's really cute.
I will to go back a little bit to what something I did appreciate about this movie. I think it did do a good job of kind of showing one face of what was going on with the family, and then slowly and somewhat subtly kind of showing you how each one of these characters is really feeling this immense pressure and sense of responsibility from their abuela. Yeah. And that was good. A little heavy-handed at times. I mean, the song is literally called Surface Pressure, but, you know, take what you can get in a movie like this, in my opinion.
I'm the strong one. I'm not nervous. I'm as tough as the crust of the earth is.
Anybody have any trivia?
Yes. All right. So a lot of it has to do with the movie, analyzing the movie itself. But they're just tidbits that I found really interesting. So each character's outfit in the movie actually has a physical representation of their power.
Really?
So you see with like Luisa, she has like little barbells on her dress. Isabella obviously has flowers. Dolores has sound waves. Antonio has animals, so on and so forth. They all have it. But Alma, on her dress, she has two images, which is mountains, which is obviously surrounding the village, and she has the butterfly, which matches the candle.
Right.
So on Mirabelle, her outfit, she not only has the butterfly, which matches Abuela Alma's dress, but she actually also has all of the family's gifts. So she has a symbol for everybody, symbolizing like her importance of holding the family together. Yeah. And the casita itself has butterfly imagery all woven in throughout the house, like it has butterflies in the kitchen tiles and things like that. So it's just sort of like they do a really good job of using imagery to paint that story.
That's really cool. I love little touches like that.
This movie is full of them. So another little touch would be that Mirabelle and Abuela Alma are the only two characters that actively speak to and control Casita.
I would argue whenever they're like, she didn't get a power. And I'm like, didn't she?
Oh, she totally did.
Yeah. I loved listening to that the animation team had to really fight with Disney to get Luisa to look the way that she did. That there was humongous pushback to have a character that ripped. And they've had multiple animators come out that have said that, like,
a female character that ripped.
Yeah. Which, rewatching it last night, I mean, she looks like any female weightlifter I've ever seen. It's not like she's, you know, muscles on top of muscles. Like she just looks jacked.
Mm-hmm.
She's a strong, large woman and proportional and realistic and very believable. Yeah.
I think my favorite part about that character is that they made her not necessarily like macho either. I think there's a tendency to do that to females in those types of roles where they're like so butch, they're a dude. And Luisa is very much a woman throughout this. And, you know, she cries and she's like very fragile at moments, which is really nice to see in those characters, because I also feel like, however often, you know, few and far between those moments of representation are for strong, physically strong women, they tend to get shoehorned into the masculine side. And it's like, nah.
Yeah.
Still women.
Yeah, I think that a good example of that is what usually happens with these movies is they make them comically ugly because, oh, a beautiful woman couldn't be strong and large and believable, or just a literal man in a dress and call them a woman. I immediately think of, even though this character was played by a woman, Fran, I'm going to try to pronounce this last name, Sadanovskovich Davidovitskivsky. I mispronounced that, but she is the woman on the purple cobras in Dodgeball, who is supposed to be obscenely strong and scary, but comically ugly, enormous unibrow, and very deep, very masculine voice, which doesn't need to happen. So Loaiza was a really good character in that sense. So one thing that I really actually saw, because I only saw this movie for the very first time yesterday, I've been out of touch. The river in the movie is actually based on a real river in Colombia called Caño Cristales, or the Rainbow River. And it is this gorgeous river in...
Oh, it looks exactly like it.
It really does. Like, look it up. Look up Caño Cristales, or just do what I did and Google River in Colombia Encanto. And you will find images of this very real and incredibly gorgeous river that has these plants under the water that give us this rainbow appearance.
Isn't it gorgeous?
It's beautiful.
Another little inside trivia was that when Alma...
We didn't do Inside Libby. We did Encanto. Okay.
No, I'm not laughing at that.
When Alma is presenting each of the children or grandchildren with their magic gift and their door... On the door, there is always a physical representation of that child when they are older. So you see that with, you know, all the little kids standing in their door. And then there's like the grown up version of what they become. When Antonio, the youngest, goes to get his door for the first time after the door ceremony doesn't work with Mirabel, Mirabel is actually the one who leads him to his door. And the picture on Antonio's door is him as a little boy. Yeah. He's the only one that doesn't have the physical representation of him as an older an adult. And so that's sort of reference that Mirabel is actually transferring over the magic and the power. And she sees Antonio for who he is rather than like what he needs to be for the family like Alma was doing.
Yeah.
Or where I thought you were going with this. These doors show what these people grow into, and Antonio dies as a child.
You suck, and you need to take that crap out of the universe right now.
Shut your fucking mouth!
No problem, John.
Shut the fuck up! Shut it!
So, before we get into the science of today's episode, if you want to find Sam and I on Twitter, Sam is at Big Dr. Fishboy. I am at Hasek Adam. If you want to read any of Libby's work, you can check out shortstorysoup.substack.com. Read about a collection of wonderful short stories. Also, gang, exciting news. We finally figured out what was going on with our Discord. So if you have been trying to find us on Discord to chat with us about various science topics, stories, movies, video games, to play video games with us, because we love to play those, at least three of us do, we realized that we are not currently searchable on Discord at this moment. So if you want to join the Discord server, please do so. We'd love to have you. You need to click on the link in our episode description, and that will be below this episode you're currently listening to right now. You can also check out the About Us on our website. That is cinematicaanimalia.com, where you can check out more stuff about the podcast itself. And if you want to see more of the more, quote, hardcore science that Sam and I do, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com, where you can find writing by myself, Sam, and a large team of international writers.
Basically, what happened with the Discord, y'all, is that Adam didn't want anyone to beat his stats in Deep Rock Galactic, so he went in there and made it so that people couldn't access it.
Seems realistic.
And none of you ever will, so just kidding. If you can, we'd love to play with you. Moving on to the science this week. So Encanto was a very interesting movie for me from an ecological point of view because there aren't any true monsters that exist. But it does raise some very interesting ecological concepts, the main one being that of a biogenic habitat. So a biogenic habitat is a habitat that is made by either an animal or a plant. Theoretically, it could be made by fungi. I would assume if it's a large enough network or a large enough individual colony of fungi. But effectively, you have a group of animals or a large animal, and same thing for plants, that creates habitat that other animals or plants live on, in, or around.
Ooh, I know this one. Anemone.
Sure. You have that. You also have the sea anemone, which is an cnidarian, a relative of the jellyfish that you can find in the oceans. But another great example, also in the oceans, are corals. Corals are cnidarians as well, relatives of jellyfish, sea anemones, and they make these sometimes massive structures that many other organisms live on, in, or around. Another example is forests. Forests, although they are composed of trees, I think by default, I'm not a treeologist, so I don't know if that is the exact definition of what a forest, I mean, you can have a kelp forest in the ocean, but in terrestrial systems, you tend to think about trees. you can have forests usually made of trees, hence the expression seeing the forest for the trees. And what these trees tend to do is produce shade, which will reduce the temperature, raise the precipitation or humidity, and completely change the environment compared to that environment outside of the trees. And what I think is happening with Encanto is that this house is a biogenic habitat created by either a single massive organism or a colony of much smaller organisms, much like coral or a coral reef.
Which this segues nicely because, I mean, aside from big macro ecosystem situations like corals, trees, this can all happen in more individual senses as well, where we can have organisms that actually have little micro ecosystems that are present on them. Bringing up what I feel is becoming this podcast's favorite creature, the sloth. I've been hearing for years that sloths are known to host entire ecosystems of invertebrate species that are unique to sloth fur. There's been previous reporting that alongside the symbiotic fungi and algae that, you know, give them their camouflage, we talked about this before in our Ent episodes, there can be up to 950 species of, or 950 different moths, beetles, cockroaches, and even worms. Now, I finished reading through a really nice piece from one of the big sloth sanctuaries of Costa Rica, and they wanted to set the record straight last night. So basically, what they ended up doing is they wanted to talk about the fact that they do not feel that this variety of organisms that's represented on the sloths is true. And apparently there's been some creep out in the future that people have said, oh, sloths are dirty if they have cockroaches or worms growing on them. So they ended up taking a group of sloths and they ended up putting them under anesthesia and then taking samplings basically from the different material that was found in their body so they could actually get a semi-representative idea of what organisms actually are living on sloths. Because it seems like we've just piled on organisms over time where everyone's been like, there's flies and there's an elephant and there's no. And what they ended up finding was that each sloth had an average of 150 moths within the fur. Only two beetles were recovered and identified, found to be scarab beetles. And there were no cockroaches, worms, fleas, leeches, or ticks found. There were a variety of different algae species.
Interesting.
So they are really diverse in terms of, but we can actually have these big organisms walking around who've got these cool little micro ecosystems growing on them.
By the way, I looked it up because I wanted to know if there was a term for a group of sloths, and apparently there wasn't, so they held a public vote, and the overall winner was a snuggle of sloths.
Yes! That was the right choice. Science sometimes gets it wrong, but that was the right choice.
I love a snuggle of sloths, and to Dave's point, you also have these type of micro ecosystems or microbiomes within your own body, if you're a human, and I hope you are if you're listening, but also share us with your dog. We'd love to have some canine listeners.
Or Mark Zuckerberg, because he's not a human.
Yeah, reptile people are also welcome. Or robots, even. Within your gut, you have, I'm sure you've all heard of the gut microflora or the gut fauna, basically the community of bacteria that lives within your intestines that help you with the various biological processes that your body carries out, be that digestion, retrieving nutrients,
poop,
staying healthy.
Poop. Huh?
Although this house is a much larger, more fantastical version of that, in theory, I have no problem with a large, most likely colonial organism hosting all of these smaller organisms within it and having a form of symbiotic relationship. And Dave, I think you had something for us on symbiotic relationships?
Yeah. I mean, I was going to go back because if you haven't cried at Finding Nemo, your heart is broken and you might be Adam.
Or you definitely are Adam.
The relationship that exists between clownfish and anemone. So there are only 10 species that actually coexist with 26 species of tropical clownfish.
In ecology, the term coexist or coexistence means that there is evidence for two organisms that will basically limit themselves more than they limit another species. So if you have clownfish species A and clownfish species B, both living in the same reef, let's say, whenever clownfish species A is at a really high population density, they will be competing with other members of clownfish species A more than they compete with species B. That way, species B is able to, on average, have a larger population growth rate. They will increase in number, while conifer species A decreases in number because they're competing with themselves too much. But over time, that will then switch. Conifer species B will now be the dominant, the more numerous,
the more
numerous species in the environment.
So the funnier fish.
Yeah.
They will be the funnier fish. The audience will love them. They'll have a great Metacritic score. And because conifer species B is now the more numerous and the more dense population, they will be competing with themselves more than they compete with species A. Species A now has the advantage when they're rare, and they will then start to grow in number while conifer species B starts to decline. And if this relationship is stable through time, that is when you can say that two organisms coexist locally. Technically, what these organisms would be doing is co-occurring.
There are a number of different sea anemone species that coexist with tropical clownfish.
Co-occur.
Multiple species of sea anemones that coexist with tropical clownfish. Within these species, only select pairs of anemone and clownfish are actually compatible. So, and they form this symbiotic relationship, which is really cool. In this situation, the symbiosis that exists between these organisms is brought about through a variety of different ways. So to live among the anemone, clownfish must protect themselves from the nematocyst strikes. Now, Adam, do you want to tell us what a nematocyst is? Because they're so cool. No, nematocyst was what I meant to say.
The nematocyst. It is a cell unique to cnidarians, so that group of organisms that includes sea anemones, jellyfish, and corals, that has a little stinger at the end that will burst out and inject venom into either a prey organism or potentially a threat and as a form of self-defense. And this is what anemones have, and that's why you don't want to touch a sea anemone.
Yeah, and what they use to protect themselves. So these little harpoon-like stingers. The clownfish has actually evolved a number of different ways of actually protecting themselves from the strikes. So the first way they do this is they don't try to eat the tentacle, which is a really good way not to get stung. So as much as we're going to talk about their ways of protecting themselves, one way of not getting fucked up is just not to fuck up, right? You don't want to fuck around and find out. So if you just avoid the fuck around part, our clownfish can get struck a lot less often. The second way that they do this is that they are protected by a thick mucus layer on the outside of their skin. It's much thicker than average. And as a result, in situations where they might accidentally bump against the area that they could be affected and get stung, they're not going to be harmed or poisoned. Now, this symbiotic relationship allows the clownfish to get a area where they're protected. They can live within the sea anemone. And hey, having a house that lashes out and protects you, it's a pretty good system. Now, what do they provide in return? Well, the big thing is that they clean the sea anemone, removing various problems or parasites that might be present. They do provide nutrients in the form of waste. They're basically fertilizing in the area. And then the last thing is they will actually keep away predators, such as the butterfly fish, who to a sea anemone is objectively a dick that will show up and is capable of actually chomping down on the sea anemone. And this relationship is really cool, and it's one that we cite really often, right? You get to live in a house that protects you, and as long as you help to protect it, as well as take care of it, you can form this really cool relationship.
Yeah, and it's something that we've talked about a little bit before, where you have this continuum between symbiosis and parasitism. And this case, I didn't realize it was a symbiotic relationship. I thought it was one of those in the middle ones called a commensalism, where the sea anemone would host the clownfish, and it would neither get anything from it nor suffer any real drawback from having the clownfish, but the clownfish would get a benefit. But because they're both getting a benefit, that is symbiosis. Now, what I think is potentially happening here in Encanto is most of the family has a symbiotic relationship with the house. They are in the village as a whole. So they are giving services, abilities, some of them. Most of them don't really, it's not really clear what they provide to the village. But Lisa, for example, is doing fucking everything in this village and literally changing the course of a river because she's that goddamn strong. And she's providing a massive service. And so she gets powers and she also gets shelter and potentially protection from whatever. I'm not very familiar with Colombian history, but I'm assuming that they are touching on some part of Colombian history whenever Abuela Alma's family fled across the river.
It's the A Thousand Years' War.
The Thousand Years' War. So they are protected from the horrors of that war by their mountains, and what they give is then services to the village and to the house, potentially itself. Now, in a lot of these systems, you have what are called cheaters, and they are the ones who will try to take benefit from their host or from the symbiotic partner, without providing anything in return. I'm not quite sure what the cause is. Maybe it's something we don't see. But for whatever reason, the house and Abuela Alma has decided that Maribel is not contributing to the house, to the village, or to the family. And as a result, she has been cut off with no gift. And in a lot of ways, with no affection or sense of belonging from her family, except for Antonio, who is too young to be indoctrinated into this horrible way of thinking.
Or her parents, I would say.
Wait. So... is or Bruno a cheater or is he a parasite? Because he's contributing nothing while just stealing food from the pantry adjacent fantastic room that he's built for himself.
I would say Bruno is a commensalist, or he's gaining the benefit, but the house and the family, by return, isn't really suffering any kind of cost because, for all they know, he's not there. So because of that, I would say commensalist.
And he's patching the walls. Well, he's not patching walls.
Hernando and Ernesto, maybe.
He also entertains the rats. That's a very important job. They could be running all over the kitchen, but instead they're putting on telenovelas for Bruno.
The rats give him the telenovelas, and he lets them, not to his knowledge, use his toothbrush as a wash, which is disgusting. Even though rats are much, much cleaner organisms than you think they are. But I think this movie should just be called Encanto, Symbiosis to Parasitism, potentially.
It's a very catchy title.
It is, I know. I'm surprised I didn't go with it. It is, it's hard to put a finger on what some of these relationships are, but they do seem to fall somewhere between that mutualistic or symbiotic relationship towards parasitism, but maybe not quite. What's good for you is good for me. Together we live symbiotically. What's good for you is good for me. Together we live in symbiotic harmony.
Going back to the beginning of the house, because I want to sort of start from the beginning, and Adam, your help walking through us, and I want to build this house from the ground up, taking all this information we've talked about.
Well, that's how you usually build a house.
All of this starts on the side of the river with a candle, right? The candle is placed down on the ground, and we see a butterfly flying by. There's some large explosion that takes place. The candle takes on sort of a very distinct quality. And then the candle is brought up to the hilltop where it's left, planted, however you want to put that. And from it are our house springs, our casita. So there are species that are brought about secondary to fire. We've had a little bit of a discussion before. And the two terms that are used are serotony, which is the term that I've used before, but apparently the term that I should have been using is pyrescence, which is the situation in which a flame or a buildup can cause certain types of seeds, which have very thick woody structures basically around them that are broken apart by the flame and are activated, allowed that they are able to sprout, usually following forest fires. Now, I don't have any concerns with this plant-like or, you know, whatever its original biological origin being in a situation where it needs fire to germinate. And I think it's a really cool idea of, one, either this organism was present in the soil at the area that they just happened to drop the candle, or two, dropped by the butterfly. We keep citing the butterfly as one of the things. We know there's a variety of different organisms and spores that are often carried on insects. If this was acting as a fomite, basically something that transferred it and just happened to run into the flame, there's obviously some sort of chemical or compound that was present in the area as well that triggered a small explosion, which is what allowed the soldiers to get knocked out of the way. I don't have any great answer as to why all of the mountains grew up. Maybe they're on some sort of tectonic plate area, but now I'm just grasping at straws because at nowhere in my education did I ever become a geologist. And Libby, you're not a secret geologist, right?
Almost, but not quite.
Okay, that's fine.
Just four more years.
I think she's a secret physicist.
It's so, quantum physics, but no big deal.
So the house sprouts up. Basically, it probably grows slowly over time with our humans living within it and gaining certain abilities that they use to draw in members of the town and grow a community that kind of protects this organism around it. The powers that come about, they could all be really useful for protecting the home. I had the same reaction that you two did of watching this and being like, not all of these powers are going to be really good for helping the citizens that are out there. And I would argue, yes, a lot of them won't. But almost all of the powers would have significant benefits to the house as a whole. So aside from the powers that I don't have great explanations for, example, being able to see the future, which would have a great advantage for any organism that's trying to protect itself from future changes, or
it would drive you insane. Right.
Well, I mean, I would argue that might have happened. Or in a situation where you're able to physically talk to animals, again, a feature that would have major benefits for the house. But the more realistic components, if this house is releasing compounds or somehow altering the genetics of the creatures that live within it, the family Magical, then it's really realistic to think having a creature with increased strength who not only can defend you, but also raise your reputation from the village who we see works to protect the casita. They literally rebuild it at the end of the movie. Makes total sense, right? That goodwill that's put out there, creating that sort of beneficial relationship and building a system of protection. Yeah. Isabella being able to disseminate plants and basically spreading vegetation around you that probably helps with nutritional balances and basically protects the home as a whole. Total sense.
Also draws in other organisms. Whenever you have people that have let their property or their homes, quote, rewild, will see an increase in all kinds of different organisms. Because once you have that foundation to an ecosystem, be that plants and fungi, you see other plants, animals, other fungi really start to move in and start to take over or inhabit that biogenic habitat.
And I would argue that as much as we may love the sinister idea of the house is secretly eating people to get its nutritional value, I think similar to the clownfish, enough humans just simply defecating in the area around this house and providing new nutrition as well as cultivating the landscape is probably going to do exactly what this house wants. Having a human being that can hear large distances, again, fantastic. Dolores would be awesome for keeping yourself safe from predators or oncoming threats if literally you can hear them coming from miles away.
Or Revolution, right?
Yeah.
So she's known in the movie to be a tattletale, so she could hear any talks around the town of people planning to attack the house, and she will tattle right to Casita.
Healing foods, keeping your soldiers and the creatures that live within you. We have lots of organisms that secrete antibiotic compounds. I think that's most likely what's taking place here. I don't think that Angie would be able to secrete any compounds that would cause the immediate bee stings to improve, which animation-wise, great scene every time that takes place. Also, what a fantastic partner. I hurt myself all the time. If I could just walk over to someone and be like, I need a snack. My leg gets all floppy.
And a tasty ass snack too. Right. She's not just serving them stale pretzels. It's like arepas con queso. Hell yes.
But an organism that's naturally creating antibiotic compounds that can be given to your soldiers to fend off infections. Wonderful. And then the last one, probably my favorite because it made absolutely no sense to me that was the worst power, was Camilo's mimicry. Like, they try to make it cool in the movie that he can turn himself into other people and, like, take care of the babies when the one woman, like, needs to sleep. Like, she's got to have a mom. She's got to have a sister. Right. That he can, like, grow slightly taller to hang a banner. I was like, you got the most useless power here, man. But we know that organisms like the mimic octopus can use this ability to scare off predators. They can attract mates or attract other members you might want to bring to the village, and that could be really useful within certain types of interactions with colonies outside of your own.
They can also attract prey.
Yeah.
So the movie we might not be seeing, because we don't really see, what's the character's name again?
Camilo?
We don't really see Camillo too much in the movie. What might actually be happening is he is just posing as a very attractive person to lure in outsiders around the village.
Yep.
To then put into the basement, aka the murder hole where the house eats him.
Yep. I just feel like it's the cartoon version of like the, you know, Bugs Bunny putting on the lipstick.
What, you mean that really hot rabbit?
Yeah, exactly.
Which is always such an insane premise. Sorry, just to go back to Looney Tunes like we talked about during Space Jam. The idea of a human hunter chasing after a rabbit, and that rabbit puts on lipstick and a dress, and all of a sudden, oh my god, I've got to fuck this rabbit in a dress. Elmer Fudd, what are you thinking?
I would also argue that this house may have a structure more similar to what we see with ant colonies, with exactly what you guys were getting at, competing queens with a new organism that can basically restart a new colony, which I would argue is what took place at the end with Mirabel. That she's the one who activates, she's the one who gets her face and her name on the front door and seems to almost take control of the house at the end.
Out of the way, Granny.
She's the next Germinator. Now, over time, though, having a population this small with this very limited gene pool might create some problems, right, Adam?
It would create an enormous amount of problems, which I think is what is actually going on in this story itself. So I would guesstimate there are maximum 300 people in this small village located in this valley around the house. Now, Iceland, by way of comparison, has a population as of 2020 of 366,425. So not that many, but over 100 times more people than the small village has. Despite having over 100 times more people than the small village has.
And access to the globe.
And access to the globe. Iceland's population has a bit of an inbreeding problem. Now, to my knowledge, it's not necessarily a case where people are marrying their siblings left, right, and center. I don't mean an inbreeding problem in that sense, but they have such a limited population that people have to be careful when they meet someone and they want to get down to business with them and potentially start a family with them. I don't know if it's every dating app, but I know of at least one dating app in Iceland that actually tells people how closely related they are to one another, because if you are first cousins with somebody and you start having kids, over time, some of those kids are going to look a little weird, and they might have some birth defects and some congenital problems and be sick and not the healthiest individual they possibly could be.
By the way, I love how you say, again, get down to business like we're some G-rated podcast. I mean, now, fuck. They won't fuck.
When these Icelanders want to fuck. Well, in Iceland, they call it, it actually translates from the Icelandic to getting down to business. Okay. So I was just trying to be considerate. Mm-hmm. Iceland, despite having this problem, still has over 100 times more people than this small village in Encanto. At the very least, this village has been around for, I would say, 40 years, potentially up to 60, depending
on... It's at least 50, mm-hmm. because that's how old the triplets are.
Right. And they came in with a handful of people. I would guess
25 to 40. Yeah, to 30.
There are now hundreds of them. To get that many, these people would have had to have been fucking each other, raising families, and the members of those families would be fucking each other and raising more families. Now, there may have been some genetic diversity in those original settlers of this colony, this city, this village in the valley, but there's only so much genetic diversity to go around. And the more these people are having kids with one another, the more and more and more inbred they're getting, the more that inbreeding coefficient builds up. So what I think is actually happening is that all of these people, with the exception of some of the older members of the village, Abuela Alma included, are probably riddled with congenital defects. They might not be the most mentally acute people. They are probably in a really bad place, biologically and evolutionarily speaking. So they might just be living in a cave that has some water coming in. There might be animals living in and around the cave. There might be some natural vegetation or fungi that these people can then use as resources. But in their minds, it's this magical house they call Casita that protects them and provides them with these magical powers. But maybe Luisa is just a normally strong person and everyone else is just really, really weak because they're all riddled with congenital defects. And while this is a not so pretty version of what this movie is, it is what I immediately thought of when I saw these mountains surrounding this village and nobody seems to be coming in or going out. So
I hate the idea that Bruno is just an average intelligence human who like walks up to like a guy and he's like, hey, your hairline is starting to go back a little bit. You've got a bit of a widow's peak. And he's like, and then I went bald. I was cursed. And it's like, oh,
yeah. He like understands that goldfish's life cycles are short. So he just says like, oh, like your goldfish is about to die.
You're really putting away those cakes. You might get a belly if you keep this up. And then I got fat.
And then Dolores just has normal hearing. Nobody else can hear as well because they're riddled with congenital defects. What else do we have?
As much as I enjoy how this idea could connect and explain a lot of things in Encanto, I hate this idea to its core because it takes away my magical world. It's like reading a couple of years ago when someone put out an explanation that Pokemon just takes place in a post-apocalyptic Fallout wasteland where... Basically, there's a group of children who've got a very limited lifespan who've been cooked by the radiation and wander around throwing rats at each other and watching them fight and being like, it's so magical. And I was like, I love how well this explains things, but I hate everything about this.
Do the Pokemon games take place in a post-war society?
An age of war had begun. During the fierce fighting, his dear Pokemon was sent to the battlefield.
So, long story short, this magical, fantastical village in the mountains in Colombia is a hop, skip, and a jump away from being just like all the European royal families, which, aka, in case you didn't know, they're all related, and they all have anemia because they're all the products of inbreeding, and when you inbreed, lots of recessive traits come to the fore, and one of those is anemia. So, like I said, riddled with congenital defects.
You know, on that note, though, I have an alternative story suggestion. What if...
Okay.
What if Abuela Alma is really Baba Yaga, and this is her hut, her magic hut, and all these people aren't her children, but victims that have wandered into this forest in Colombia, and she's trapped there for eternity?
I really like the image of... famous Slavic witch Baba Yaga moving from Eastern Europe to sunny, warm, and tropical.
She got to retire somewhere.
Taking up residence with her. I know. She lived a long life roasting and eating children alive. So, yeah, you know.
But old habits die hard.
I'm just imagining the villagers talking. Yeah, Abuela up on the hill is great. Her Spanish is shit.
Sure, that house is on a single chicken leg, and she's always flying around in a mortar and pestle, but hey, what can you do?
I wanted to take this time to acknowledge the entirety of this episode and thank our super fan, Monica, for the suggestion of Encanto.
Ooh, yeah!
So, it was a great suggestion. I was obviously very thrilled with it, because I like this movie a lot. So.
Yeah.
Thank you, Monica. So for story today, I wanted to talk about what are Disney movies kind of known for? They're fabulous villains. Cue Ursula.
Ambiguously gay villains. Oh.
Exactly. Ambiguously gay villains.
Cue Ursula. Cue Ursula all the time.
Exactly.
Scar.
So my question that I'm posing is, can a story be successful without a good villain for our hero or heroes to fight against? So I kind of wanted to talk about, like, let's look at how, as storytellers, we can accomplish that first. So one way to do it is situation. So rather than fighting an evil, a character must overcome an obstacle. So the conflict for the thrust of the story arises from internal or external sources, aka a society that makes it difficult to succeed or self-doubt internally in the main character's head. A great example of this is A Christmas Carol. So you have Ebenezer Scrooge, and there's not really a villain. I mean, he's kind of the villain, but he's also the protagonist. So Scrooge has to overcome. He does have to overcome that bald spot, Michael Caine, I'm sorry. Scrooge has to overcome his own internal problematic issues in order to defeat the conflict of the story. So a second way to do that is minor antagonistic characters. These are characters that don't really pose any threat or any real substantial threat to the main character, but rather point out the struggle or make the journey slightly more difficult. Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland is a good example of this, where you have a lot of crazy people, like Caterpillar, Humpty Dumpty, the Mad Hatter, all of these people who are kind of making Alice's journey a little bit more difficult, but they're not necessarily a villain. Then you have the false villain, which basically is a villain that is not the conflict of the story, but reveals the true conflict of the story. A great example of this would be Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. So you have these objectively horrible little villainous children, which aren't all children, but they slowly dispatch throughout the entire movie, right? You have the famous one, Violet, turning into a blueberry and being rolled away. Yet the conflict for Charlie remains, because the real conflict isn't the mean kids of the movie. It's Charlie's own struggle with poverty. So he's sort of overcoming that through the use of these false villains. So that's kind of like the main three ways that you can do a story without a villain. So my question for you two then would be, since Encanto does not have a true villain, do you feel like they succeeded in this narrative, or do you feel like it would have benefited from a villain?
I loved that this movie had no villain. It's so refreshing to see that like a family dynamic fight can make a film all on its own. I kept expecting that like when the house blew, the walls were going to fall and we were going to see creatures from the Thousand Year War. And I'm calling them creatures because dick moves, who come flooding into the area, and then they have to like use their superpowers to bound together and fight. And I was actually incredibly refreshed that I didn't get that, that they could just have like internal struggle and expectations in something very human in a magical story be the primary villain.
I definitely appreciate all those points that Dave just touched on. And I think that in a different movie, I would have appreciated them a lot more. And obviously the story would have been substantially different if there was a more actual villain to this story, to the movie. But for a movie that I felt what lacked cohesion and a real driving plot beyond, oh, I didn't get a gift, bummer. Oh no, the house has a crack, I guess I'll fix it, without any real driving force behind it, or in my opinion, interesting drive to do that, especially for, yeah, it was very, I keep using the word ambiguous, but it was a very ambiguous whole narrative for me. So maybe having that central focal point that everyone in the story can then kind of rally to overcome and to defeat together could have made this a more enjoyable experience, but that's just me.
I fall in both camps. I think that I really enjoyed not having a villain. I think that it was really refreshing to have that internal conflict, and I did love the family dynamic problem. I don't feel like they made it clear enough. In a lot of cases, you do get the sense that Alma is very strict, but not necessarily problematic. It's kind of an aftermath effect where you see how problematic she was. And I feel like they needed to do a better job almost villainizing Alma, and making her that transgenerational trauma more apparent throughout the beginning of the story, rather than, oh, it makes sense now after I've watched the end.
Agreed.
Yeah. So I feel like I don't think they needed a villain. But I also feel like they fell short of making the conflict strong enough, because there wasn't enough of an obstacle throughout. Rather, they clarified the obstacle at the end, and then you retroactively understood the entire process. So, kind of mixed.
Enough! You are all of you beneath me. I am a god, you dull creature, and I will not be bullied by that.
Puny god.
Dave, I think you had some questions about, or maybe thoughts on which power you would want and why.
Yeah, so question to you guys to round us out at the end. Of all the powers that are existing in this movie, yeah, whose ability would you want and why would you want it?
I feel like as a child, the ability to transform would be super fun and very enjoyable. But I think that raises a lot of interesting implications, especially as an adult, with questions of identity and potentially what that would mean for how you do or do not change whenever you change with these other people. Do you have their thoughts now? Can you speak the languages they speak? Do you lose that sense of self? What are you actually?
At the end of the day, if you move away from this point, I feel like you're screwing Libby in this conflict, because I feel this opens up her options. If she's like, hey, Chris Hemsworth tonight.
Why Chris Hemsworth when you got Rachel Weisz for the rest of your life?
Or Paul Rudd. Yeah. I'll take any of those.
I think that for me, Louisa's would probably be the most interesting, because I think it's the most practical and the least horrifying. If I could hear fucking everything, I would lose my goddamn mind. Yeah.
I mean, mine's a toss-up between talking to animals or making some insanely badass Mexican or Colombian food that heals you.
Yeah.
I am not horribly accident-prone, but I bruise really easy, so I would just love to have non-bruised legs for once in my life. That would be great. You know, every month when I get my period, boom, menstrual cramps, gone. Absolutely. And you get tasty food out of it. But ooh, I think talking to animals is also young Libby's dream. I think that I've explained it away in my head of, even if they are simplistic and you're not having full-fledged, you know, theoretical conversation with them, you could still understand and communicate via their behavior and be accepted into their pack, or, you know, perceive yourself as not a threat and be able to get close to some really cool creatures that you wouldn't able to otherwise. So I think that's still pretty cool, even if they are simplistic. So I think it's a toss-up.
I would argue that Isabella or Pepe's powers would allow me to be a evil god and are definitely the most powerful ones in there. The control of weather, or just generating vines and plants. Realistically, Antonio's powers would help me a lot at work, but it would be simultaneously a heaven and a hell, because every time you have a dog that's like in a cage barking, all I would hear is, let me out, 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 let me out. But that being said, being able to sit down any pet and be like, please just tell me, like, where is the pain coming from? Is it the hip? Is it the stifle? Where is it going on? Would make my job 1,000 times better. I can tell you that my part...
I can't imagine.
I can tell you that my partner really wanted Louisa's powers, just because she secretly just wants to be super strong for a day. We recently finished watching Amazon's Jack Reacher, and the only comment that we had all the way through from her was, I would just love to be him for a day. She's like, I could run at night and no one would whistle at me. She's like, I could go to like the store and people would obey me and they'd give me what I want. No one would judge me at the mechanic. She would definitely love to be Louisa for a day.
I very much appreciate that, and I think that that's a great sentiment, but I worry that it wouldn't change a thing.
If you can pick up the car, the mechanic's going to listen to you. If I'm the mechanic and someone comes in and lifts up the car and shakes it at me and is like, I want this fixed by 4 o'clock, you can bet your ass I'm fixing that car by 4 o'clock.
So I think in a lot of ways, Julieta's powers, I'm assuming that's how to pronounce that. I could be wrong, so forgive me if I am. Maybe the best one overall, because... we have her, we have Tia Pepe, who controls the weather with her emotions. It could be because of this stress from the emotions, but she looks significantly older than Julieta does. Bruno, also in a very stressful situation, but he also looks significantly older than Julieta does.
He looks like shit.
Julieta looks very young and a lot healthier than her siblings do. And as I just said before, that stress could play into that. But if you have the ability to heal... she could theoretically be healing the telomeres, which are at the end of her DNA, which fall apart, that actually kind of cause the aging process. She could halt aging, wrinkling, balding, to slow down the metabolism, what have you. And I think that that may be a really good way to extend your own life, if you were so inclined. Pick Julieta's powers.
Did you just pick every power of the family? We gave you an option to pick one power, and you went through...
I didn't pick every power. I would pick Louisa's, because I think that's the most practical. But I think that there is some added bonuses and a lot of extra horror to the other characters' powers that are implied based on what they can do that aren't really discussed.
You're basically evil.
Dolores would be insane. She would be insane.
You were evil Professor X. You're like, if I can't have these powers, I just want to keep all of these people near me so I can use them when I want them.
Mm-hmm. You're exactly. A Mirabelle.
Fair enough.
Wolverine, favorite X-Man. I've made the decision to fire you because you are worthless. Made of metal, the substance that the guy we fight the most can manipulate with his mind.
Do we feel bad for the house? Is there anything to feel for this theoretical inanimate object, but we're saying living organism?
No, if it's a living...
Or group of living organisms?
Yeah, if it's a living organism that's protecting people, protected itself, and was destroyed in the process of trying to protect its own little clownfish, then yeah, I definitely feel bad for this organism. I'm glad it got brought back, but it's got something going on.
Yeah, I think it depends on what version we're going with. If it's the evil entity? No. If it's just a harmless creature trying to protect its denizens, then yes.
I feel like I don't really feel anything for or against this house, even in the implied animate character the movie tries to make it be. There wasn't enough character to it beyond moving some tiles, waving a shutter at somebody to make me feel anything for this building. And even if it is a group of organisms, like a coral reef, providing habitat and structure, those organisms do die eventually in nature. And it seemed that this one reached the end of its life and the next generation or the next, its progeny took over. So I don't really feel bad.
That wasn't a shutter, by the way. That was a butt cheek. It was just waving both the butt cheeks. Mm-hmm.
So next week we'll be returning with the Wheel of Time, specifically the Trollocs from the first episode, though I'm sure there's going to be plenty to touch on with the rest of the series, and I'm excited to actually watch it, because I have not watched it, nor have I read any of the books associated with
it. I think we'll have a really good time with it.
Nice!
Shut up.
Oh, that's the title right there. It's so good.
It will be the... So, goodbye, everyone. This was my last episode of the month. Decided to quit.
But you live with me forever.
No. As you say at the end of every episode, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Casita. Oh, yeah. Drawers. Floors. Doors. Let's go. This is our home. We've got every generation. So full of music, rhythm of its own design. This is my family, a perfect constellation.